Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Getting my dad to say I love you.
To say what?
Say he loves it.
Outrageous.
Bloody nonsense.
Dad, this week's guest is none other than Ellis James. You know Ellis James now, do you, Dad?
Well, I've read about him, yes.
What did you find out?
He speaks Welsh. He is Welsh. He's very keen on being Welsh. He was born in Wales, went to university at Cardiff in Wales. Seemingly worked in Wales before he became a stand-up comedian.
Yeah.
His first comedy gig was in Welsh. I think at they have this festival called, I never know quite how to pronounce it, at Eisteddfod or something like that.
Right.
But it's a Welsh-speaking thing, and he does comedy in Welsh. But
he does. He's a big proponent of the Welsh language. Very proud Welshman.
But yes, it's an interesting thing. I mean, how many people actually speak Welsh is an interesting question.
Let me go chat to Ellis. Oh, yeah, beforehand, I want to ask you this. What's your weird name you call the toilet sometimes?
Oh, the Welsh Embassy.
Yeah. Why do you call it that? Is that an offensive name for it?
I don't know, really. It was an expression from my friend Tim Launden, who's a member of my club.
And you've never questioned the etymology of it?
I've never really asked him for the etymology, but it'd be interesting to know where he got it from.
Find out and come back to me next time, or we'll find out if it's offensive.
Yeah, I'll find out where the Welsh Embassy comes from.
In the meantime, let me go chat to Ellis. I'll see you later. All right, I love you.
Thank you. Sorry.
All right, we've got good friend of mine, Ellis James, on the podcast. How are you, mate?
I'm very good. How are you?
I'm good, man. I'm good. Before, what I always like to kick off with, before we just get into small talky stuff, is just have both your parents said, I love you before?
Yes.
To
oh,
you,
yeah.
To you.
Yeah. Yeah.
They said it out loud, because that's what I had to think about it. This is where the podcast came from. In the pandemic, I was like, well, I know my dad does, but I don't know if he's actually said the phrase to me, I love you, because of, you know, various
I know my dad does.
But has he said it?
He must have. I mean, he must have done. I'd never thought of this, and That's really weird, because I know he does, and that's never been in doubt. I've never had any issues around this, and I've never. It's not the reason I do what I do, and it's not the thing that drives me. But I can't. He must have done, but it's not like every time I ring him up, he says, "I love you."
Yeah.
Whereas I say it to my kids all the time. God, that's weird. It's. Because my parents were affectionate, certainly for the time. Because I grew up in the 1880s. That's what a lot of people don't realise. But I'm actually 141.
I mean, sometimes you do reference stuff that makes me think that's true. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. I think I'm too interested in the 1880s, and people think I am over a century older than I actually am. But
the ghost of Ellis James.
Yeah. Yeah, he was. My parents were sort of physically affectionate, but I don't think they say it as much as I say it to my kids. I often tell my daughter that she's my number one G, meaning girl rather than sort of gangster, and I sort of wrap it, and then I might chuck in a couple of I loves you, and she loves that. And I say that to my son, and he's three. Doesn't mean anything to him. He doesn't care. But that's quite a fascinating question, actually.
It is, because this came about. This is the second series now, but it came about in lockdown because I was chatting to some. I'm sure you were doing all the Zoom, like trying to keep yourself sane, even though I look back at some of the Zoom stuff we didn't thought was kind of insane. But we were all talking, me and some come of other creators, like writers out here, and then me and this, my friend Tim, were like laughing about it. I don't think my dad is, but I'm the same. I know he does. He loves, he just shows it in a different way. He's from a different generation. His mum and dad would have the broadsheet newspapers open and then just nod at him in the morning. So he's not used to doing it. And then I was like to him, just say it. And he was like, well, I don't want to say it. It was just, it's too like mawkish or something. It's the weird or a guard being let down, but there's different love languages. I'm aware of that. And so it's good to know that your parents still showed it in other ways.
You used
but
to
it's
say
funny
well
that they didn't
done
say,
a lot.
They don't say, yeah, exactly. That's a dad
you used to
way.
Say, well done. I'm proud of you. That's really good. So I felt encouraged.
Mm-hmm.
There were definitely friends of mine at school whose parents didn't encourage them at all. And I think there were mates of mine at school whose parents thought that good parenting was to be effectively silent from the age of 0 to 18. Then you would leave home with their blessing.
Yeah.
But no, like my parents, after... Do your parents come to your gigs?
My mum never came to one for so long. And then eventually she watched me at the Tabard in Chiswick. You ever do that preview gig?
Yeah, which is, I think,
worst.
Is hard. I think
it's one of the worst gigs. And just, it's even though I used to work in that pub because it's where I grew up. And I just had such a shit gig. And
yeah, I've never had a good time there in my life.
And I think she was like, I've been doing it for a few years. She was like,
Chris has lost his way.
Yeah. And
Chris
then
has lost it. He's doing my dad,
my dad's, yeah, exactly. He's gone. He's gone in the head. He's gone. He should give up now. My dad has I've talked about him quite a lot on stage, less so my mum. And then weirdly, my dad's always like, he used to go do a boot camp in Chiswick. And he kept talking to Al. Yeah, he kept talking to Al Murray, the pub landlord Al Murray, about me as a comedian in that sort of proud dad way.
Yeah, so yeah, yeah.
But and then my mum, the last time she watched me was in London, and she watched me a couple of times since. Do like better gigs, but I did a different preview. I think it was a preview, and she didn't laugh for any of it, apart from the 2 minutes where I talked about her.
Oh yeah, Izzy, my partner, her parents came to a show of mine in Edinburgh, which was by a distance the worst gig of my life.
Oh,
because
God.
I had a stag do in from Glasgow, who decided to just ruin it, and I was in a little room in Edinburgh called The Attic, and it holds 55. And the gig started at 8 o'clock, and my sort of door person, she said to me, she said, listen, we've only sold 40 tickets, but I've just had a call up from the box office. A group of 15 want to see you. Are you fine with that? I was like, of course it is.
Ugh.
It's Saturday night. That sounds like a great idea. And they were a stag do. And I got off to a very, very bad start because they just hated me. And I think they decided that they were going to try and make it difficult. And
isn't that just a funny industry that we're in? I got off to a bad start because a group of strangers decided they hated me just by my appearance and tone.
It was bad. And I remember after about 10 minutes, the guy went, I'm off to watch your football. Fuck this. No way. I'm off to watch your football, man. So he left, and I said, but what football? Because I said, Celtic are playing tomorrow and Rangers played last night. There's no SPL tonight. He went, oh, there's German football on in the pub. I'm going to watch a German football, man. And I was like, oh, okay. And I thought, well, at least
And that's when the Bundesliga wasn't as, as kind of hipster and cool as it is now.
But I thought, at least he's gone. And then he came back in about a quarter of an hour later, and he went, right, Werder Bremen 1, Hamburg 0. Borussia Dortmund 1, Bayer Leverkusen 0, Bayern Munich 1, Schalke 1. And he read out all the results as it was happening. And I just had to let him do it. And he went, football's shite, you're shite,
But I paid for this, so I'm going to come back and watch this.
Oh, no. And then he why sat down and continued to heckle.
Why did the door person let him back in?
And because the girl I'd work in the door was an 18-year-old Spanish student on a gap year.
Oh, God.
And obviously it's not her job to stop some 40-year-old Glaswegian
human teletext.
And Izzy's mum and dad were there. And her auntie, and they just watched in silence as I lost control.
Oh, no.
Cool. And then at the end of the show, my mum and dad were there as well, and their friends.
Oh, you had double parents.
I had double parent, and my mum and dad's friends, Brian and Anne from Croydon, had come up, and I'd never met them because they'd worked with my dad before I was born. And they came up, and that was bad. And then one of the stags had come up to me and apologised. He said, sorry, man, we just chose him at random. I thought, well, really, fuck this guy, he's gag up, you know, thought it'd be great. And I said, well, it wasn't great, was it?
Ugh.
That was really hard. Brian and Anne are here. Until 2 minutes ago, I didn't know who Brian and Anne were. Now I found out that they work with my father. a year after he got married, before I was born. And I said some things I regret, and I used some big words, some of the rudest words, and then he got angry with me, and I thought, how are you angry with me at this stage?
What did they say after? What did the parents say after that?
My mum incredibly said, well done. And I said, Mum, I said, are you having a fucking
Not now, Mum. Not now.
Not now.
Not now.
Dad said, do you want to have another chat with Brian and Anne? I said, of course I don't want to talk to fucking Brian and Anne.
Oh, that's the worst. That's actually worse than a parent watching you have a shit gig. It's a friend of a parent who, because you know the parents are probably being like, oh, my son's doing pretty well, he's good. And then they come and then they have to be like, ooh, you're brave. for doing that whilst having very little ability is what they're thinking.
And then I had to go and chat to Izzy's parents and say, that's my job.
Oh, God.
God, I love your daughter.
Yeah. Luckily, I'm really nice and courteous and I'm very good at listening. So I've got that going for me. So let's drill in a little bit on your parents then. So your mum's well done. So from a young age, you said encouraging. Were you?
Yeah.
When did you? What? How old are you when you started doing this? I'm trying to think.
When I started doing stand-up.
Yeah.
I was 24.
All right.
And I didn't go full-time until I was 28. Well, about a month before my 28th birthday. So I'd had like real jobs for...
Yeah, how were your parents... Years. About like what you finished school and obviously here's the thing I keep saying about everyone is this industry, whether it's comedy, writing, whatever, you've got to have, there's kind of two things that I think are common, is like a fearlessness and a fearlessness and a work ethic, right? So I feel like you had them in you even if you didn't go straight into it. What were they encouraging you? Did you come out of school going, I want to do this, that, and the other? And they're like, go for it. Or they like, do what you love. Or, yeah. What?
My mum was a careers officer in a university. So she helped students who were graduating get jobs.
Right.
Like graduate jobs. That was her job. And she'd also been a careers officer in secondary schools. She was never my careers officer, but that was her job. And she loved it. And she loved finding work for youngsters. That was she like, my mum didn't retire till she was 65 and she loved work until the day she finished.
Mm-hmm.
So she'd always drilled into us that we should do what we were happy doing, what we wanted to do. So my sister's, one sister's a pharmacist and the other sister is she was a midwife and is now a nurse, like a sort of health visitor. And that was great because they excelled at that.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with me, I think I had vague ideas of either being a musician or maybe writing about music, like for the NME or something. That was kind of something maybe I wanted to do because I actually knew someone in a proper band, so it kind of felt achievable. And I had met the odd music journalist when I was at university, and that was their job. So that kind of felt achievable. And with comedy, I'd never met a comedian. I'd never met anyone who was involved in the comedy industry in any way. So even though comedy was the thing I wanted to do, it felt completely closed off, like this weird closed shop of people who tended to have gone to Oxford or Cambridge, usually Cambridge, actually, because of the footlights and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I'd never been to the Edinburgh Festival. So even though I loved comedy and I used to tape it off the TV and I used to analyse it with my friends and just lap it up, read anything I could about comedy, it seemed as unlikely as if I'd wanted to be a model.
Yeah.
Or a surfer or something, like just something completely out of my reach. And then an open mic night started in a place I used to go and drink in. And I thought, oh, hang on, this is interesting. And they were asking for open mic comedians, and a few of my friends said, you should do that. And then once you do that first open mic thing, you meet mm-hmm. other open mic comedians who've usually been going a little bit longer than you, and they say, well, actually, there's a gig in every town, and if you become successful, it can be your job, which was a world I had absolutely had no experience of. And I was talking to my mum about this quite recently. She said that after a couple of years, when I still earned very little money from comedy, and I was by that stage working in a cafe and working in a pub, and I was working in the cloakroom of a nightclub and that kind of stuff. Apparently, I was always... She remembers me being quite positive in that, oh, I'm driving to Bristol tomorrow and I'm going to earn £30. As long as I do that every night for the rest of my life, I'll be absolutely fine.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they were always very encouraging. I think because I was quite unhappy doing real work. I did office jobs and I was very bad at them. I don't have any of the skills necessarily. What were the real jobs you did then? You worked in a pub, obviously.
Do you know what? Once when I came out of school and before I went to university, a teacher really liked me, this history teacher. And she was like, a friend of mine runs a PR company. Do you want to work there like 2 days a week?
Oh, wow.
All I remember is I went for so many shits just to not be in the office. I would I would just be like, I'm going to go to the... I literally was not... My brain from, but you're talking that thing of like not wanting a real job is, it feels like it's not the reason I did comedy, because I was obsessed with it when I was a teenager. But I always remember because my dad hated his job and he just said to me every day, never be a lawyer, never be a lawyer. Yeah. Whatever you do, don't be a lawyer. So I was like, and I remember people at school and they're like, oh, what you know? I'm like, all I was wanted to do is not, I wanted to have a fun job, something that I was excited by. So that pushed me, like I did a bit of that. And then I worked in Gap, the clothes store Gap, for a bit. And then I was a PE teacher momentarily. At my old school when I basically finished university and was like, it's that talking of that, like if I'm doing, there's something really exciting when you start comedy, isn't it? Because you're going, good, if I keep, something about moving forward is very exciting. So I was like, well, if I work in the day at my old school, and I do this. It was like not even, it was like even PE assistant. I was putting cones down.
Yeah.
Someone else was telling them to run through them. I was putting them down. But then I was like, if I just do this for a year and then do stand up and then I can just about make it work. And then it did. And then, you know.
I have to say to any of your listeners, Chris is one of the most naturally gifted comedian footballers I've ever had the pleasure of playing. And I love playing football, but I'm going to use this word. The word I'm going to use is poise. So... Such poise on
delighted,
the ball.
Delighted, mate. Delighted.
Lovely first touch. You've always got more time than the other players in midfield.
Oh, mate, you're making me miss.
And you're picking a pass. You very rarely give the ball away.
I love to part. That's the one thing I always find funny about comedians football. This is a tangent, but if people care, they'll listen. It's so funny, like, a lot of the most successful comedians in the country are the most selfish fucking football players. They never pass, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas I, and this is not me to damn myself, I love assisting. I love putting that ball on a plate
you're a collaborator.
For someone.
You've always been a great, you've been
I've been
great
a collaborator, mate. I love putting it on a plate. I love playing the one facing. I love keeping things simple.
The word I'm going to use is purlo.
Oh, mate, I'll take that all day long. I'll take it all day long. That's more important to me than performing a sold-out run at the Apollo, is
well,
you
calling until the until I hurt my knee, and I now can't play football. Certainly not at the moment. Fingers crossed it'll get better. I was playing twice a week, and I was playing with Rob Beckett on a Sunday night with the parents at his kid's school. Mm-hmm. And the first time I played with them, I turned up a bit early and I said, what are they like, Rob? And he said, the standard is very similar to comedians' football.
Okay.
But just imagine if people passed, because comedians are selfish by nature. And we're like, it's how public schoolboys used to play in the sort of 1880s. It's just head down and dribbling.
Yeah, there's, I'm not going to name the comedian, but there's one comedian that I found out from another, I can name check the person who's up, Milton Jones, who's very good, told me there's another comedian who would only count having fun at comedians football if he scored a goal. he would be like, I scored today, it was fun. But yes, we have diverged a bit, but I like that. I'll take that. I'll enjoy that.
How did you get a job putting cones out as a PE teacher's assistant?
This is the problem with chatting to just such an accomplished broadcaster. You've somehow turned my podcast interviewing you into you interviewing
me.
Let's talk about that kind of the work ethic thing, and we can somehow bring this back around, which is, I was like, well, I don't want to have a 9 to 5 or a 9 to, because then if I have to do a gig that's 2 hours drive away or 3 hours drive, that's going to be hard.
Yeah, of course.
Whereas if this thing was more like, was it 8 to 3 or something?
Yeah, yeah.
Then I was like, well, I can do that and I could make it work. So it was all about facilities. I can get to Leeds for 50 quid.
I'll be wearing shorts and a vest.
I'll be very easy to spot. I'll be in high vis. Half the audience put on these bibs. Split you guys into teams. On my left side, you'll be wearing the orange bibs. On the right side.
I'll have a big whistle around my neck. great way of getting people's attention.
You get heckled, listening. You just whistle. Oi, yeah. oi. It's your own time you're wasting. But yeah, so that's what I was doing in the day. But no, let's go back to, let's bring it back to the premise of the podcast, even though this is more fun to me sometimes. But your mum, so she was like, she could tell you were happy. What's your dad? What did your dad do? And what's his reaction to your this is not meant to be, but before you did comedy, it sounded like you were, this is the harshest word that's come to my head, but I mean it in a nice way, a bit aimless in what you were doing.
Oh, drifting. My dad was a quantity surveyor.
Right.
And my mates growing up loved my dad. He was more fun than me. He was funny than me.
That's my dad as well, mate. Was he a big drinker?
Not really, but people used to knock on my door and ask if my dad was coming out to play. Right. And I would say, I can come out to play. And they'd go, yeah, fine.
Okay.
So we had this great scenario growing up with our primary school teacher didn't think that homework was good for kids. So once we finished school up as 3, it was done. So, you know, I had a nice back garden. So we used to play football in the back garden. My dad, certainly the weekends as well, would he'd be like reffing games and stuff. Really, really enthusiastic. And he's a real laugh, my old man. And I think that, I imagine that it's difficult to be a laugh if you're a quantity surveyor. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Yeah. And that's what he did. He did that for, you know, 40 years or something.
Yeah.
So certainly 35 years. And so I think when I said I want to be a comedian, I think he thought, brilliant, just go for it. Nice. And there are absolutely friends of mine whose parents didn't encourage them and wanted them to do something very safe. But I must admit, there are no sob stories for me on that, in that regard. And also, I think I was unhappy working in offices. I did a lot of data entry and I did a lot of temping and stuff. Mm-hmm. And because I didn't want to live with my mum and dad because they live in a small town. So I remember thinking, you know, even though I get on with them, I don't want to move back because there's nothing, you know, I would find it hard to move on, I think. So I did loads of data entry and office work and had a bit of a fright because I'd enjoyed university and I liked my course, but I didn't want to take it any further. And I remember once when I was doing data entry, I remember I was queuing up in a post office to get like road tax or something on my lunch break. And the queue was so big, I thought, I'm not going to have time to eat now. But I've got to get the road tax. And then I remember thinking, 23.
Yeah, I know.
Is this it now?
I know.
And I'd had such fun at university and I had such fun at school. I remember thinking, fuck, is this it? Oh, shit. And so I would do anything. I would go anywhere and I would go to the north of England. I would go to Scotland for open spot, Cornwall, London, Essex. It did not bother me at all. So I ended up in one office job that had flexi time. So I was able to leave early and it meant that I would take anything. And every single gig felt like a step in the right direction, even if it wasn't. And every single gig felt important. And I didn't go to people's birthday parties and I didn't, you know, go to people's social events and stuff. And because, I mean, awfully, if it was your birthday or I was offered a gig that was 10 quid in Southend, which is a sort of 8 hour round trip, I would have done the gig.
Yeah.
Because after 4 or 5 years, I remember thinking, shit, I need to make this work because if I don't make it work, I've got nothing else really. And I've got a history and politics degree, but I knew I wasn't cut out for teaching. And I did an MA because I really loved history. And I realised during my MA that I was just too thick to be a historian. I was sort of good enough to get to that level, but I thought the proper historians, and also they are, as much as I liked it, they are obsessive people because you can't write 200,000 words on, I don't know, whatever, the miners' strike without being obsessed with the miners' strike. And I knew I wasn't into it that much. So it was kind of, it was plan A or make plan A work because there is no plan B.
But I like the fact that you got from your dad there that like, you could tell there's something probably subconscious or not where he's the fun guy and you see, so in terms of comedy, you become, there's something very romantically interesting about being funny or fun and people enjoy being in your company.
Yeah.
That must have been a thing.
And it had always been the way I communicated. So if I was meeting new people when I was working in a new job or when I went to uni or when I, you know, if I was ever in a situation where I was meeting people for the first time, I would try and make them laugh.
Oh, and boy, it's the way.
I don't know if... And my mates tended to be like this. So I thought that was how everyone communicated.
I know. It's so funny. Have you ever met a group of people where they're not like that funny? It's so weird.
Either they
act like you're insane or they find you so funny that it's like, it's quite worrying. You're like, can you just call me an arsehole because I'm not really used to this level of effusiveness.
My friends from school were all like that.
Yeah.
And one of them, my friend Sian, went on to be a comedy writer. She wrote the sitcom Man Down with Greg Davis, and she wrote a sitcom called Tourist Trap. And she was exactly the same. And all my friends, even the ones who didn't go into comedy, did that. And it's only when you meet really serious people, they think, God, this is shit. This is so shit.
I know. It's like, what is life about if you can't like laugh? Like it's nothing about laughter to me anyway, but you know,
so yeah, it was, I think the reason I'm quite happy is that you'll know these people. There are some comedians, their aim is to be the best comedian in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I once shared a green room with someone and we were just talking about our ambitions. I'd said there must have been a TV show I'd like to, and I said I wouldn't mind giving that a go. And then I asked the question, what are your ambitions? And he said, I want to be the greatest comedian of all time. I thought, of all time?
It's a bold one.
So you've got Buster Keaton, Harold Lloyd, Charlie Chaplin, Richard Pryor, Morecambe and Wise.
Oh, okay.
I thought the greatest comedian of all time.
Funny.
But that was his ambition. And the reason I'm quite happy is that my ambition was for it to be my job.
Yeah, that's a big... Not having a real job continually is... It's a hard one because you want to have these hopes and dreams and you want to progress, but... And you sometimes you've got to take a step back and go, this is fun. This is my living.
Yeah. I'm currently in the middle of buying a house, and last night we were up, Izzy and I were up late, signing all these documents and reading all this stuff. Almost none of it is some stuff I understand. And the mad thing about buying a house is for about 3 months, you're expected to be a solicitor and say, yeah, yeah, sure, sure. Yeah, we'll do that in perpetuity. That sounds like a good idea. Yeah, sure, sure, sure. And I've signed stuff which I've barely finished reading and all this kind of thing. And I remember thinking to myself last night, I'm 41. I should. This is the stuff that you thrive on when you're 41, isn't it?
You should know it.
I should be into this. And I think I probably have quite a childlike ambition to sort of have fun all the time. And occasionally worry that this is a bad example I'm setting to my kids, because I do have fun most of the time. I love my job. And I regard myself as tremendously lucky. And I know that I'm lucky, which is why I would say I'm quite grateful, because I've done lots of stuff that I didn't enjoy. And that's hard, because you know people say life's too short. If you really hate your job, life is too long, because it's a long old day.
Yeah.
And I think I'm lucky. So I hope my kids understand.
But you're not you're lucky to. I mean, there is luck in this field. But when you talked about missing birthdays and all that to go to somewhere for 10 quid or whatever, that's a work ethic thing that comes into it.
Yeah.
And then there's a fearlessness as well. That's what was interesting to me as well, when you said, I have to make this work. Is that like, that work ethic is like, I know you said your dad's fun. I guess that's like, it sounds like it's kind of a little bit linked to your mum. She was like, she loved her job so much and she got so much out of it. So you're probably watching that and going, if I can love a thing, I could, that's keep doing it, because that's a special thing.
And my old man worked very, very long hours.
Yeah.
So, I don't want to make it sound like I've been working down a coal mine or anything. But
don't worry, mate. It's fine.
I did.
I live in LA, mate. Just dial it up a notch. Big yourself up.
I did think, okay, well, if this is going to work, then you need to gig as much as you can. Otherwise, it's not going to work and you're not going to get anywhere. Mm-hmm. And I'd realised it was something that I could do, because I think I didn't have a bad gig probably until gig number 4 or 5. And then when it was really bad, I thought, okay, 1 out of 5, that's a ratio I can handle.
Yeah.
And once you have died on your ass and been made to look really, really stupid in front of a bunch of strangers, you realise, well, no one's died.
Mm-hmm.
And my girlfriend hasn't left me. My parents still love me, so it's not that bad. And I think that, there were plenty of comics I knew who were more talented than me when I started out, who when they did have bad gigs, it would affect them so badly.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think I was lucky in that I had a relatively thick skin. I had some absolute shockers. Bloody hell, I did one in Bristol. Bristol Jonglers, did you ever do that?
Yes, I did. Yes, for my sins.
August the 9th and 10th, 2013, which was the last time I worked for Jonglers. I was probably the least funny person in Europe that night. They wouldn't have been a comic on the continent having a worse gig than me. I only lasted about 10 or 11 minutes. And I just walked off. I was like, this is going nowhere.
That's so funny.
And I remember
when you have to go off early.
I remember trying to lick my lips because my mouth had gone dry and I couldn't do a full circuit of my lips because my tongue was so dry because I was so nervous. I couldn't lick all the way around.
You had the most arid mouth in Europe that night.
And I remember my shirt was sticking to my back. And it wasn't even heckling. Heckling, I would have been able to at least blame on them. It was abject silence. It was a sort of angry, seething apathy.
Oh.
But again, I remember getting the train home and thinking, that was on the Friday night, thinking, I'll be absolutely astonished if they rebook me for tomorrow. I'm going to get a phone call tomorrow morning saying, you're not good enough. thanks, but no thanks. Yeah, we'll be in touch. And then they won't be in touch. And they didn't get in touch. And then I remember turning up at the venue, assuming I was going to be sent home. And the manager went, "Hi, Al." I thought, oh, they don't give a shit.
Yeah.
And the Saturday was better. So the Saturday, I sort of got away with it. But
I had some moisture in my mouth at the end of the set, which was the new bar for having a good gig in my mind. I could lick my lips.
I was able to lick my lips. I had a lip-licking gig.
Yeah, you brought a chapstick with you in case, as a backup.
I was able to lick my lips. That's how funny I was on the set.
Did he blow the roof off? No, but I moistened my lips.
No, so. But... Oh, check that out.
Does that sound like I had a bad gig?
Yeah.
Come here, son.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass!" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Do you know what I was thinking about? I don't know why I woke up this morning and I had this real urge to tell you, you're a catalyst of a human. I don't know why. This is not. I wanted to tell you, when you walk in a room, you just energize it as just your personality.
That's a very kind thing to say.
I suddenly thought about that because I haven't. We did shows in New Zealand together. And
yeah.
I just always loved just having drinks or food with you.
But that was good fun.
But yeah, that sounds a bit like something you've kind of had passed down to you from your dad, but you like to talk about all the self-deprecating stuff, which, you know, I love as well as a Brit, and out in America they're not so into that. But
well, I got told, right,
by
a big producer, we were putting an idea together. They didn't go anywhere in the end, but we got it in front of a commissioner. It's a few years ago, and he was quite a big dog, this bloke. He worked for a big company. And he said to me before we met the commissioner, we were about to go into the office, and he said, "Listen, the self-deprecating stuff, I love that. Really funny. Great. In a situation like this, it would be damaging."
Yes, it's true. Remember,
you want them to think you're good. And I was right.
Yeah.
Really good, funny guy.
You'd be crazy to say no to this. Yeah.
And if it came off as really inauthentic, are you mad? Because you would be mad if you didn't give me 10 series straight off the bat. Which no one had ever said that to me before.
That's true. In those circumstances, that needs to be. Well, so that's what I want to talk about is when you get a win, because you've had you probably don't class them as wins, but when you have like good news in the world of Ellis James, do you tell your parents? Are you excited to tell them? Like when you sell out a big venue through your podcast, or you've got too many successes.
I do tell my mum and dad. I tell them for different reasons, actually. So I tell my mum because she's proud of me, which is very nice and lovely and something I really appreciate. My dad, my old man, I tell him because, like a lot of dads, he's concerned that I'm not going to earn enough money.
Yeah, that's the thing. That is a common.
So
thing.
I
do you tell him the money post tax earnings from each?
I would never ever tell my mum my fees for anything because she's not interested. But like when I used to do circuit gigs, my favourite circuit gig was the Cardiff Glee Club, which was 200 quid.
Yeah,
and this is a great way of how dads think. So my dad came into the dressing room, actually. He came into the dressing room, and this was back in the days when they still used to pay you in cash. So they used to pay you on, used to do the Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and they used to pay you on the Saturday. So guy paid me by giving me 600 quid in cash from under his hat, right? Lovely little touch.
Yeah.
And my dad saw this, and then I put it in my pocket, and he went, "Oh, much was that then?" And I said, "I said you get £200 for the Thursday, and obviously you do three gigs for 600 quid in total. £200 for how long? 20 minutes. Right. £200 for 20 minutes. So that's £600 an hour. Yes, I suppose. So if you were a solicitor or accountant, that would be your hourly rate would be 600 quid. Yes. So if you could do gigs, 9 until 5. Monday to Friday. And he was working out what I would earn if I was able to do stand-up at like 9 a.m. on a Tuesday morning.
Oh. Brilliant.
Like my pro rata rate. And I was like, well, yes, you're sort of right, but those gigs don't exist, do they? There are no.
No.
Half past 10 on a Wednesday morning stand-up shows, unfortunately.
Just in morning break at a school.
And that's the kind of thing he would sort of hone in on that then.
Yeah.
And he'd want to talk to me about that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's a very, my dad's a, how much? How much of that? How much? It's always the first question. Even if he's supportive of the endeavour and the fact you're chasing your dreams.
And he would always compare it to something from his world.
Okay.
So he'd say, well, my friend Dennis, he's a builder's merchant. And I know that if he sells X amount of concrete, then he makes. And you're like, yeah, completely irrelevant to what I'm doing. your friend Dennis selling a lot of concrete.
But what does Dennis, is selling concrete as profitable as stand up? If he sells,
I think Dennis used to sell a lot of concrete.
A lot of concrete, mate. I didn't know you could get 200 quid.
Yeah, he works for a concrete products company, and he earns blah 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 blah. And my friend,
that's
Jeff.
Such a dad thing, though. Just to, well, I mean, that's a human trait, isn't it? Just to, how do I relate this to my world? And the funniest relation to his world is concrete retail.
Yeah, he's got. He what he does is he hires out power washers. And he hires out these power washers, and they're £30 an hour, blah, blah, blah. So he clear £8 per power washer's profit straight from into his pocket, no national insurance, no snap, no tax. So how many power washers did you sell at? I don't know.
So when you, but when you, like, so he it's money's the thing you'll tell him. When you get, when you've got like, what have you got? Your radio, you got your, I mean, podcast. Your podcasts are very popular. Your new ones are. Do you and John still do a pod? Do you do a radio show?
Yes, we do a radio show that
which
is
has a contract and a salary attached, which you can explain to your dad. Explain to your dad. Your podcast popularity must be more tricky because it's a bit more irregular. Right?
Yeah, it's. I think with the podcast is interesting because that's now the main thing I do.
Do you do much live stand up anymore?
No. I wrote a show in Welsh. I've written three of them. So I wrote one in 2015, 2017 and 2019.
Yeah.
So 2019 was the last time I did stand-up. I've done live stuff with John and I did another podcast I do called Associated in Sports, but we did a tour where we did the podcast live.
Yeah.
But I've not done sort of just me and a microphone stand-up.
Yeah, what is that? Why is that? I'm curious. Because I've gone through my little phases recently of doing other things and I'm enjoying, so kind of... Not necessarily being like I need to get up there, man. I need to pound the boards. There's a lot of people out here like the pandemic were just like, I don't care if I die of COVID. I just need to tell people about my week.
Yeah, I saw some really amazing stuff that was funnier than me, and also it was kind of more important. So I remember, I saw Bridget Christie's show, A Bick for Her.
Oh, yeah.
I thought, fuck, that is funnier than anything I've ever done by a mile. And also it's about an issue that's really important. And so I'm less funny than her, and none of the stuff I talk about is important in any way. Shit. And I think what happened a little bit was I did Edinburgh 08, 9, 10, 11 and 12. So I thought I'll have 13 off because I deserve, I didn't have any good ideas and I thought I'll just have the summer off and see what happens. And then in 2014, I was in a sitcom, so I wasn't able to write a show. And then we had a baby. So 2015, I didn't want to go up because of the baby, because I didn't want to be away for a month. And then 2015, I was 16 then, it was the Euros. Wales were in the first tournament for 60 years. So I didn't want to miss that. And that was happening at the time when I'd be previewing.
There's a difference here between your dedication to stand-up from when you started. You were giving up birthdays and then you're like, the Euros are on though. I know it's Wales, but
it was that weird thing where also I was able to work over there.
Yeah, that's true.
So I worked at the Euros. And obviously I went to the games and that was undoubtedly the best month of my life. And also my daughter was still only two. So, she'd have been two in October. So I just, and then what I realized was I wasn't enjoying stand-up at all because I wasn't doing new stuff.
Yeah.
So then I just stopped enjoying the circuit because all of the stuff by that stage, apart from a couple of minutes here and there, a couple of jokes here and there, would have been like 2 years old. I just found it quite an unpleasant experience, sort of trotting out my greatest hits. Mm-hmm. And then, and I thought that I didn't like stand-up. I thought that's what it was. And then, because Welsh is my first language, so I've just dropped my pen because I was making a point. I was forcefully making a point. So Welsh is my first language. So SWC, the Welsh TV channel, said, would you want to write a stand-up in Welsh, a stand-up show in Welsh? I said, yes. So I thought, I did a little tour to build it up and then I recorded it and I loved every second of it. I realised, the thing I actually like is writing new material, not performing it. That's the thing that really excites me, is actually writing a new show. So that scratched that itch and then I wrote another one 2 years later. And I wrote another one 2 years later. So I haven't written a show since 2019. And then partly because it's my first language and partly because I found a funnier comedic voice and comic angle, I find writing stand-up in Welsh now easier than in English.
Well, actually, weirdly, my dad had done some research on you and you're kind of answering it now, but Paul, have you got the question that my dad has specifically for Ellis? Because it's funny that you kind of transitioned into this.
Yes, I have.
The question to him is, does his comedy translate well into Welsh?
Does it translate well into Welsh? My dad, he'd looked you up and he wanted to know.
So when I first got asked to write that show in 2015, my first thought was, oh, great, I'll just translate a load of English stuff. And it'll take about an hour and then I'll just perform it. It'll be fine. And then I realised, I gave it a go once and realised it didn't work for a variety of reasons. And then you think, okay, well, if you spoke Welsh at home and you spoke Welsh at school, and with your friends, and obviously there's a different cultural background, I thought, well, I should probably write some stuff about that because there's loads of stuff from my childhood, for instance, that I was never able to do in English because people didn't get the references. But I'll have an audience in front of me who do get the references. So it's a bit like going back and having a second go at your first show. It's quite an interesting position to be in. And I loved it. I really, really enjoyed it. But Wales is a small country and there aren't enough towns to do like big tours.
Yeah.
So you're going on telly having done like 16 previews because there just aren't enough towns big enough for you to do lots of shows. So with each tour, it gets bigger and I realised I could do shows in London because there are enough Welsh speakers here. And I did a show in Edinburgh last time because there are enough Welsh speakers in Scotland. People come over from Glasgow and stuff. And next time I'll probably do them in Bristol and Liverpool because there are definitely enough Welsh speakers in Liverpool. And I realised as well I had a slightly bigger audience than I'd expected. So I did three nights in London. I think I could probably do more. And I did five nights in Cardiff in a little room just because you're trying to practice and run it and it's a work in progress. And what I realised was my old stuff in English stopped working because it had been written in a completely different time of my life.
Yeah.
Whereas, so now it appears really dishonest and inauthentic. And in Welsh, I've kind of got three different ways to attack the joke because my grandmother didn't speak very much English. My parents obviously do speak English, but are Welsher than sort of, I've got a Welsher life than me because I live in London. And obviously my kids live in London. So you've got kind of four generations or in four different angles to attack the same thing. So it just meant that I found writing routines and coming up with punchlines more easy. So I'm doing a new hour for the first time in May. So I'm working on that at the moment. But Izzy, after a long gap, has gone back to stand-up. So she's got a gig tonight. And because she didn't do it for about 8 or 9 years, when she went back to doing it, her enthusiasm was like an open spot. She would come back from gigs wide-eyed.
Yeah, yeah.
Honestly, like, oh my God. And then I see how much she's enjoying it. I think I probably should write a new 20 in English so I can
do
it. Because I miss comics and I miss being in...
I know, I miss... I relate, though, a lot to what you said about the exciting bit is the new stuff. Some people love, and that's nothing, not a slight on them, I actually kind of... People love just crushing, as they say, with, like, stuff you know is amazing. And just, like... I don't care. Like if I don't put a new bit in, I don't care.
I prefer to have a 7 out of 10 gig with new than have a 10 out of 10 gig with old.
Yeah.
And obviously, I don't want to die on my ass, but I found it hard. And then when I found it harder to write new stuff, I stopped enjoying it. And it was really weird. And then I got offered, I was lucky enough to be offered other stuff. So I started doing that. And then it kind of takes you in a different direction. So it's weird. It's something I never thought I'd quit. And I haven't quit entirely. But and the other thing with podcasting, when I first started doing stand-up, podcasts, they probably did exist, but I certainly didn't listen to them.
Yeah.
So now it was never my childhood ambition because I'm not five.
Yeah.
So it's a funny old position to be, but I think as long as you're involved in comedy in some way, that I'm happy.
Yeah, as long as you're still not having a real job. And you're making bring people joy, like your dad did to your childhood friends. Look how I segued that back like a professional.
That was really good.
Mate, this has been great. It's been a bit about everything, which has been great. Before we wrap up, a couple of little things. Your parents seem like they're together, I assume.
By the way.
I kind of took that. This seems very lovely. They seem like just the sweetest. I want to meet them. I want to meet their friends. I want to meet
my mum. This is lovely, right? I think Joel Dommett's mum is a bit like this, and Joel Lycett's mum is a bit like this. But my mum came to Edinburgh. My mum and dad came to Edinburgh in 2009, which was the first solo show I did. Just to support me. No, it wasn't 2009. It was when I did the a package show with lots of comics called Comedy Zone. They came up that year and they went to see my friends and then they went home. But they had a brilliant time, my mum especially. And then in 2009, when I was doing a solo show, she saw all of the same people she'd seen the year before doing different stuff, but ventured out and saw a few more things. And 2010 came back. And now my mum has got the most esoteric, eclectic taste in comedy. Now she'll go to Edinburgh for a week and she'll watch, it's like 8 shows a day.
Amazing.
And so sort of mainstream stand-up that you see on telly on a Saturday night doesn't interest her. She knows what all the tricks are.
Oh, lovely.
So she's interested in some weird sketch group.
That's quality.
Just because it's different. And my mum would honestly watch a gig a night. She gets the brochure out and she's got her favourite comedians. And she'd never, ever been to comedy before she came to see me do it. And now it's one of her main interests.
That's great. So that's a lovely gift to have given to your mother, I think.
Yeah, I'd never not thought of it like that. But I can't pretend that I had a hard life. I was my mum and dad.
No, it'd be great content if you could. But
it would be good. And I've had a go at them for that. I've said, thanks, mum.
I would be the greatest comedian.
Thanks for being so bloody supportive, man.
I'd be the greatest comedian of all time if you were more of an arsehole to me. Well, what we like to end up is just, if would your mum and dad listen to something like this?
My mum certainly will, yeah.
Oh, lovely. So you want to say something to your mum? You've been very sweet, so you can sort of directly say something.
Diolch yn fawr, thank you for everything.
Oh, that's lovely.
Oh, God, I've become quite emotional. Yeah, and thanks for not giving me a more messed up childhood, mum.
Yeah. Tell your dad how much you're getting paid for this podcast. Sorry, Mr. James. It's an IOU.
It's an IOU, yeah.
It's the gift of having a good time with an old friend is what he's getting paid with.
That's what you texted me. I thought, yeah, fine, I'll do it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I think I was very honest. I was just like, that's one of the things I hate. Just like, just asking people you like, and do you want to just sort of, can you do me a favor, is essentially what it is. But hopefully it's still enjoyable and fun. Before we go, the thing, I play this to my dad because I still want to get the I love yous out. And then maybe afterwards you can forensically analyze whether your dad and mum have actually said I love you to you.
They must have done.
They must have done. I'm sure.
I think my mum's definitely said it.
Chuck it out on the phone next time you speak to your dad and see if he says it back. That's what I'm going to say. It's a little test.
Yes. Yes, all right then.
Obviously don't ring him up and say I love you with nothing.
Do you know what he said? Last time I saw him, my dad's from a rugby mad village. Mm-hmm. So it's a tiny little village and it's produced loads of top Welsh internationals and British Lions. And they tended to play for Llanelli with a big club in the area. If they start off for his village team, but his village played in the West Wales Challenge Cup in 1972 and it was televised. And I found the footage of it on YouTube. And we watched that together and it was the first 15 were people he'd either been at school with or people he'd worked with or people his dad worked with.
Yeah.
And we watched it was brilliant because it was commentated on by the big BBC Wales commentator at the time. And obviously he didn't realise this was on the internet or that it had been televised at the time. And when we watched at the end, he said, I do love your visits.
Oh,
so, yeah, he must have, you know, so that's, yeah, I know how he feels.
You know how he feels. Well, what we like to do is get guests to just say to my dad, to John Martin, anything you want to say to him that might help him just sort of...
To John Martin, you know, I don't know if you love me, but God, I love you.
Yeah. You said
I've met your father once. I met him.
Him, do you? Was that at where?
It was at your wedding.
Oh, the wedding party in London.
The wedding
party
in the club.
Yeah. Oh God. Yeah, he would have been hammered as well.
So yeah, and I told him then. I said, "I love you." Put my arm around him. I love you. So now I'm saying it again.
Good, Dad. Ellis has said I love you to you, so you can at least say it back to me.
Thank you.
There we go. Mate, this has been great. Before we wrap up, you should plug your podcast. It's great.
Sure. So. Okay. I do a radio show with our friend John Robbins every Friday on 5 Live between 1 and 3 p.m. So yes, James and John Robbins show. And I do a podcast called The Socially Distant Sports Bar with my friends Mike Bubbins and Steph Guerrero, where we try and talk sport, but we tend not to very much. So if you don't like sport, it doesn't matter.
I listened to some of it the other day and I was like, you start talking about Kimbo Slice and I was like, yes, this is the podcast for me. Rest in peace, Kimbo Slice. He's passed away now, hasn't he?
Wow.
Yeah, it was a real
memory. If you like watching people fight in a back garden, Kimbo Slice is a great person to search for on YouTube.
You know, because you talk about a sports documentary, didn't you? I actually... I watched this Oscar-winning American football sports documentary ages ago, and I ended up interviewing a couple of people. I've forgotten what it was called, but just sports docs, mate. Who doesn't? It was a stand-up the other day. A gig I was at, who was talking about how she hates sport but loves sports documentaries, which is a funny place to be. We're going to end up talking for 25 minutes here about how you see.
Yeah,
it.
I've got a lot to offer on this subject.
If you like sports documentaries or just like Ellis or like sport, please listen to his podcast. It's amazing. Ellis, I love you. Thank you for doing this.
I love you too. Thank you.
A podcast from producer paul.co.uk.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.